Mary asked me to give a lecture this week, not knowing after oral surgery how she was going to feel. And she also sent a link to a very interesting talk of Okamura's, which I'm going to talk about this morning. And Okamura was talking about a short excerpt from a fascicle of Dogen's called Raihai Tokuzui. Being very scholarly, Okamura gives about a half a dozen different translations of the title, even though some of which you can tell he doesn't really agree with. But the one that's most straightforward, I thought, and simple is Kaz Tanahashi, who translates it as receiving the marrow by bowing. Receiving the marrow by bowing. So this is the title of Dogen's fascicle. Raihai is bowing. It can be thought of as giving ourselves up to Buddha's teaching. And this title, receiving the marrow by bowing, is a reference to our second Chinese ancestor, Huiko, which I generally had heard the name spelled with an E at the end and pronounced Huika, but Okamura uses Huiko, so that's what I'm using. So it's a pretty famous story. Bodhidharma is thinking maybe it's time to go back to India. And he has these four main students, so he asked each of them to present what their understanding of his teaching is, who his successor might be. So the first one was Dao Fu. And Dao Fu said to Bodhidharma, "As I see it, it is not bound by words and phrases, nor is it separate from words and phrases. This is the function of the way." So it's not separate from words and phrases, but it's not bound. And Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my skin." The second student, Zongxi, which in some translations it just refers to this person as being a nun, or maybe the name Zongxi. But Okamura said this was actually Emperor Wu's daughter, which I don't remember hearing before. And it's interesting, and I don't know the context in China at this time, but I know in India, where Bodhidharma came from, being born female was not considered such a good, it's a lot of discrimination. Like, you must have done something really bad in your past life to be reborn as female. And in Dogen's time, there were different sacred sites in Japan where women were not allowed to go. And there's actually two parts to this fascicle. The second part was written a little later and it was hidden away for some time, possibly because Dogen was very critical of the kind of discrimination. Actually, Grace Shearson has an essay in this book, Receiving the Marrow, that's kind of about that part of the fascicle. And hers is titled Dogen's Seven Arguments for Empowering Zen Women. But this part, we're talking about. So Zongxi, giving her understanding, says, "It's like Ananda seeing the Buddha land, seeing once but not seeing again." So I'm not familiar with that reference, and I was a little fuzzy about what that means. But Okamura gives some clarification. He refers to it as like seeing the absolute but not staying there. Not getting stuck, right? Having some great realization, but now we still have our day-to-day lives to tend to. So Bodhidharma says, "You've attained my flesh." And the third one was Dao Yu. And Dao Yu said, "The four great elements are empty, and the five skandhas are non-existent. There is, in fact, nothing to grasp." I was thinking if this was Nagarjuna's student, he might have received the transmission, this whole thing, right? Nothing, no essence, nothing to grab hold of anywhere. And Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my bones." And then lastly, we have Huiko. And Huiko stepped forward, bowed deeply, and stood in his place. He didn't say anything. And Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my marrow." So this is where the title comes from. This story is the example of our second Chinese ancestor, Huiko, receiving the marrow by bowing. So this excerpt from Dogen, it's very short. It's about 5.5 lines. I'll read that. After you have encountered a guide and teacher, you should cast off the myriad distractions, and without losing a moment, devote yourself energetically to pursuing the way. You should practice, be it by using the mind, or by using no mind, or by using half mind. Therefore, you should learn to practice with the same sense of urgency that would drive you to put out a fire on top of your head. Wow. Okay. So the first line is, after you have encountered a guiding teacher, you should cast off the myriad distractions. So he's addressing monastics who traditionally literally leave home, cut off all worldly involvements, just focus on practice and study. Of course, we know monasteries have a lot more going on in them, I imagine, than plenty of entanglements that go on there, but this is the idea. So how do we do this as lay people? Okumura says, at least when we sit in the Zendo, or at home, I would add, and let go, we can cut them off, cut off the myriad distractions. So I was thinking of how Sojin gave a talk at Clearwater years ago, and he talked about how whenever he sits, he gives himself a little Zazen instruction. And that really stuck with me, and I try to do that. I don't remember every time, but I try to at least check my posture, see where my breath is. If I'm feeling particularly unsettled, I might take a few slow, deep breaths just to settle in. And then this last week after reading this, I was kind of adding in, just for 40 minutes, just drop it for 40 minutes. Can't you do that? And the first few times I did it, it was really helpful. And then I suppose it becomes, you know, like things we repeat. But I intend to still continue it. I think it's a worthwhile practice. And just depends on our mental weather and what's going to happen each time. And I think we tend to think of, or I tend to think of, the myriad distractions as all these things outside of me. All this stuff I have to deal with. The news feed on my phone. The leaf blower outside, all these things distracting me. But the common denominator in all these things distracting me is me. It's not about all these things. Right? And Okumura, he defines myriad distractions are all the different kind of objects associated with me, right? Which take many flavors. There's self-conscious me, defensive self-praise, self-criticism, you know, all the ways that I put me into activities. It can be very subtle. You know, someone might say something, not really intending to criticize me, but I might notice my tone of voice changes a little bit, maybe get a little bit tighter. You know, it's just really helpful to notice these things and notice what it feels like, because it usually doesn't feel so good, I find. Actually, last Sunday at Dharma Rain, the Abbot Kakumyo was giving a talk on, it was the last fascicle in the Shobogenzo, the last fascicle that Dogen wrote for the Shobogenzo. And it was on the last sermon that the Buddha gave, which is kind of an interesting parallel right there. I don't know if it means anything. And his talk hasn't been posted, so I can't go back and check the details of some of this. But he's talking about how having a small desire and knowing or experiencing satisfaction. We tend to mostly hear about wanting more wisdom. He said as a young monk, he wanted more wisdom, more prajna, right? Maha prajna, maha, you know, compassion, all of these things that we think to aspire to. We don't hear a lot about all desire and experiencing satisfaction. As he's talking about this, I'm thinking about how he and his wife and their big dog live in this tiny house. It's not a small house, it's a tiny house on the property. That's really a small desire owning satisfaction. It's not a big property, and they probably take meals in the main house and whatnot. And he was giving examples. You know, you have breakfast, assuming you have breakfast, and there's a kind of satisfaction But do we really notice that? And if we notice that, how quickly we go on to something else? There's this beautiful wooden floor in the Zendo. He said, just take 4 seconds. Look at this floor. There's a beautiful floor in that Zendo, I know. I don't know what Kate's floor looks like, but I'm sure there's something there. just noticing these things and experiencing that satisfaction. Very, very worthwhile. Small desire. So in the discussion part, this young student, like in his early 20s, he's just recently become a resident, and he's a very serious student. And he asked, well, what if I have a really great desire to be more generous? Is that a wholesome desire? And Kakumiya said, well, that depends. You know, you have to examine it and see how much me is in there and how much is just being pulled through you, which has a completely different feel. You know, and we've all experienced this, and just when we do something spontaneously, when we see some need and we're able to do it, and we just do it and we don't think about it. And it just feels completely different than this more, than when there's a lot of me in it. So the next line, Dogen says, without losing a moment, devote yourself energetically to pursuing the way. Without losing a moment. Boy, that's that's tough. Easy to think of, like, my practice, my study in Zazen is kind of over here. Maybe you feel like it's a little special. And then there's all these other myriad distractions practicing over there. Okamura says, if we understand that my practice includes my whole life, besides what we do in the Zendo, then it's not possible to waste time. If we were able to just wholeheartedly engage with everything, there would be no time wasted. That's a high bar. It's a good aspiration. But in order to even have a chance at this, we have to have a regular sitting practice, regular Dharma study. And how to fit that in the day, how to integrate that is really the question. So the next line, Dogen says, you should practice, be it by using the mind, or by using no mind, or by using half mind. It sounds a little bit like Dofu's response to Bodhidharma. He said, as I see it, it is not bound by words and phrases, nor is it separate from words and phrases. This is the function of the way. So we need words. And yet words are not the same as enacting wholehearted practice. I've heard that Sojin would often say, don't get caught by the words. Some of us like to nitpick words. I like to nitpick words. It's kind of missing the point. Okamura says, we have to use our mind to find time to come to the Zendo and sit quietly. But on another side, our practice is concerned with not using our mind. As far as we are using our mind, it's not practice. It's not a Dharma practice. We have to use all the minds, which he calls you mind, mu mind or no mind, and half mind. I don't know what half mind means. So integrating this. Remember, in one of Sojin's lectures, he said, take out your calendar. I'm going to sit here, and here, and here, and you try that out. And if it doesn't work, you adjust it. So I know I'll have some aspiration or plan, and if it doesn't work, then I end up just not doing it. So I really like that advice. You know, if that doesn't work, try it a little different. Try it adjusting it. No, we have busy lives. I find if I want to add something in, something else has to go. You know, we have this little 15, 20 minute kind of a combination Qigong yoga routine that we like to do, and for a while we'll do it every day. But then something else comes in, and that goes out. So it's hard to make these choices. Last Sunday, Kakumiya was also talking about how, you know, there's often something we want to do, but there's something else that we know would make us feel better, would be maybe a better thing to do. And this young woman that was in the Zendo said, God, I really overslept this morning. I'm just so tired. So I'm just not going to go today. But here I am, she said. Because she knew she'd feel better. She knew that. And she was maybe barely 20 years old or something. So the next line, Dogen says, this is the last line. Therefore, you should learn to practice with the same sense of urgency that would drive you to put out a fire on top of your head. Wow. I've never really been a practice with your hair on fire kind of person. If anything, I have to be careful not to become complacent. And I think there's some schools that emphasize this more, probably more in Rinzai, more urgent fire, hair on fire practice. And depending on what's happening in our life, you know, if we're in a lot of pain, there's a lot of urgency to practice. If things are going along pretty nicely, you know, maybe not so much. So I have to watch the other side. Don't get complacent. And we hear this come up in different teachings in Soto, even, you know, the last line in Merging of Difference and Unity. It's like, don't waste time. Or, and then other times we're told, sit quietly and do nothing. Okay. So our week from today, our practice period starts. And we usually talk about how to stretch that practice, how to make a little more time, you know, without neglecting our responsibilities, our worldly duties. How do we make that a wholehearted practice? You know, what would be most useful to do? And there's always little ways, even if we can't fit another sitting period in or something. You know, when I used to work in downtown Santa Rosa, I'd get 2 15-minute breaks a day. And oftentimes I'd take one of those. I almost always go on a walk, just walk down 4th Street. But I would take one of those and I would just make my intention that this is going to be, going to walk mindfully. I notice the bottom of my shoes hitting the pavement, where my breath is, my posture, just hearing the sounds, and letting go of thoughts. So we can, you know, there's ways to work this in. I think it was Norman Fisher, it doesn't really matter who it is, in a very busy time of their life, and there just wasn't time to sit right then. So he decided, when he drove home, he walked from his car to the house, up the stairs to the front door. He said, okay, that's going to be my meditation. You know, if he has a kind of regular thing that we do in the day, that could be the meditation. I tried sitting at different times when I was working, sitting in the evening, and that had difficulties. Or I'd sit in the morning, and basically from the time I was ready to go to work until it was time to go out the door, that's how much time I had to sit. Might be 15 minutes, might be whatever. But I would encourage, if you do something like that, just to have that placeholder, just to sit down, even if it's for a short time. I found that really useful. The Dharma Rain start their practice period at the beginning of September. They do two of them a year. So, and on the Sunday that starts it, they always ask people if they want to share their vow for the practice period. There's maybe 40 people when they go around the room. And even though I wasn't like formally doing it the first couple of times, it's still a good thing just to kind of like say out loud what I want to work on. So in the first couple of practice periods we were there at the beginning, I said that I vow to cultivate more patience. And this recent one, after saying that a couple of times, I thought of saying, I vow to cultivate more patience again. But instead, unbeknownst to me, Marilyn and I were both thinking it would really be good to sit twice a day. So that's what we both vowed. And we started that early part of this month. And we both found it's just really helpful. Especially the kind of earlier on, when you notice it more, it's almost like getting sesshin mind. If you're able to do that, but I feel really lucky that we're able to do that now. I couldn't do that before for a long time. So our ancestor Huico, I think, kind of sets that example of just wholeheartedly doing one thing, wholeheartedly bowing, wholeheartedly doing each thing as our practice. So maybe some of you have some things that you'd share of how you've managed to practice during busy times. Maybe somebody knows what the heck Dogen means by half mind. Or any other comments or questions? Steve, I think you were just a little bit before.
Yeah, I really resonate with your what you said about your practice of trying something and verbalizing something like trying giving yourself zazen instruction, and that works for a while, and then that practice tapers off, and then just dropping body and mind for 40 minutes, like things like that, I also go through, and sometimes a new practice like that will, for me also, really work at first and then seem not to. I feel like somehow I end up incorporating the practice so that it's no longer special. And then a part of me says it's not working anymore. But often, if I really look closely, I'll find that somehow something sunk in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's even when it feels like maybe it's not working, I think it's really helpful to just continue it and just really notice that, really paying attention, just like you're saying you do. Yeah, thank you. Kate?
Thank you, Liam, that I liked hearing your words. And, you know, at the very beginning, I would do things that people suggested, like count your breaths. And what was useful to me about that is just noticing how hard it was to get to 10, you know, without my mind wandering. I thought, oh, well, I can do that. I can do that. I can count to 10. And I often couldn't. And it was useful because I didn't know I couldn't before I made the effort. And I don't remember now because I don't count my breaths anymore usually, but it was surprising to me. And like Steve said, I think it was when we were studying the Fupa Zazen about how to sit, Mary mentioned something that Mel said about pay attention to bringing your chest up. I used to like try and throw my shoulders back, but just to breathe into your chest and sort of see where your heart is. And whenever I call my attention back, it's usually that helps me, you know, paying attention to where that part of my body, where is my heart? Where's my heart, I guess. And that's been useful. I'm not much of a hair on fire kind of person either, but emotionally, I think for me, that can be as distracting as all the thoughts about what I need to do during the day. So if I have a strong emotion, there's a difference between letting it rise and obsessing on it, I think. And that's been a thing to refine. It seems if I let it rise, arise, abide, and pass away, then something settles. However, I have been guilty of obsessing on it for the full 40 minutes. But that seems like a challenging practice for me, as I seem to have a lot of strong emotion. And then I criticize myself for it. So I think that's all. Thank you.
I think we've all experienced that obsessing about something for 40 minutes. That's a pretty common one. Yeah. I think, the hair on fire, I mean, the way they, I think they do that kind of specifically in koan practice in some places, trying to break through something. And it could be useful, I'm sure. But a couple of things coming up organically that way. And just like you're saying, you practice with letting them rise and abide. And also what you said about just posture, it makes such a big difference, those little things, like raising up the chest. It's kind of surprising. Posture is really important that way. And I've never been able to count to 10 either. With the breath. So Mary?
Let's see. Was Kakumio saying that there are wholesome desires, these small desires with small satisfactions, that those are wholesome desires? Did I understand that right?
I don't remember exactly how he put it. And once the talk is posted, I mean to go back and look. And I'm not sure whether this was from Buddha's last sermon, whether this was referenced to, because I'm not familiar with that. So I need to look that up. But I took it more, I don't know, as looking at it as much as wholesome and unwholesome, but just kind of having an appreciation maybe and just allowing these simple satisfactions, that kind of experience.
Okay, I just
a thriving kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I make a distinction sometimes between taking pride in something and taking pleasure in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's fine to take pleasure in it. It's when it becomes, when the I gets inserted,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then it's a problem. There were I don't know. I can't count to 10 either. But I wanted the thing about half a mind. I think that's, as I understand it, that kind of phrase, it's not uncommon. And it's, if you're only available for halfway, then completely do halfway.
Hmm.
Be aware that that's what's going on and practice with what you have. Practice wholeheartedly with what's available right now. And, you know, you might be obsessing about something, or there might be some physical difficulty going on, or there might be who knows what. You might be really tired. And the point is, practice with that. Be aware of that. Use that. And if that's all you have, fine. So it's kind of maybe saying you don't have an excuse. Something like that. And there was something that you and Steve both said something about that I wanted to comment on, and I can't. What was it? The first thing you said to him?
Sort of like putting like practice that. You practice one thing and Zazen becomes part of you.
It does. That's right. That's what I wanted to emphasize. I think it becomes part of you. In other words, if you start giving yourself Zazen instruction at the start of every period, it may well be that you forget about it or it fades. But I think if you notice, you'll realize that you're doing it without thinking about it. You sort of check in, like I check in, am I pushing up with my breastbone? Is my mudra kind of round? And where is my chin or whatever? That I'm doing that, but I'm not talking to myself about it.
Mm-hmm.
That it just happens. And I think it is, I think that's the right, that it gets integrated. And it's not that you've forgotten or that it's not there, it's just integrated. It can be the same with a koan. If you work with a koan for a long time, it's sort of not there that much. But then every so often, I mean, I know for me, every so often, if I'm watching my breath and all of a sudden internally I'm saying just this, where did that come from? I haven't intentionally worked on that koan for a long time, but I'm always working on that koan. So it's just, it's in my marrow. And the other thing I wanted to say is I understand that he gave the second part of Raihai Tokuzui, because when he gave the first part and he talked about women being equal to men in practice and not to discount Zhangshi, I think is that we usually pronounce it, but anyway, how not to discount her. And then the monks were talking among themselves and they were very critical of this notion and resentful. And so that's why he gave the second part to really pound it home to them. So, I don't know, I wasn't there, but I'd be surprised if it weren't true. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know if Marilyn has any questions or somebody else has something to say. No.
Thank you for your talk. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Steve?
Yeah, just one more thing. So practicing with your hair on fire, how can that image not, you know, just kind of grate on a person? Even if a person does practice all the time, still, you can never really practice like your head is on fire. One thing that I'm interested in your thoughts about that. What occurs to me is that I do intend to and aspire to practice all the time. And sometimes that intention and aspiration feels like a weight. It feels heavy. That doesn't generally occur when I'm actually practicing, like in Zazen, or if there is a moment where I'm really with it. Of course, it's not burdensome. It just happens. So maybe it's more of a thought, or, you know, an emotion associated with, anyway, whatever. But I wonder if practicing with, like, your hairs or head is on fire is like, just put it out. You know, you can't even think about it. Maybe that's not heavy at all. Anyway, what are your thoughts on that?
I guess I think of the hair on fire a little bit differently than the practicing with everything, if I understood you right, kind of throughout the day, making your life practice, which I find, you know, the more I'm sitting and, you know, sitting twice a day, I just find there's more times during the day when I'm just present and just doing something, but still a lot of the time I'm not. And I try to notice that. But the hair on fire, yeah, I don't know where that fits in really with that. It's not something that resonates a lot with me. Maybe I don't have enough hair. Yeah, I think to me that's, I could see if you're in a lot of pain, for example, you feel an urgency to do something about that and you just throw yourself into practice. That's kind of how I think about it. Or if, you know, you're like in Rinzai, I think that's kind of the instruction with the koan, and it's built into kind of intensify things. You know, you might go into the Dokusan room and before you say anything, they ring the bell and you're out. You know, it's designed to be a pressure cooker. I think that's kind of part of how it's meant, I think.
It certainly gets your attention.
It gets your attention. Thank you.
Thank you.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Bye. Thank you.